Okay, good evening. First of all, thank you to Yossi and yeah. I didn't even try to chant, and I'm thanking you. I greatly appreciate the welcome, and it's been it's a warm source of I just feel wonderful that Yossi and the Chabad have been doing this for so long, and it really is a source of pride, and it brings me great joy. I really wish I had a mic, because this is it. It doesn't get much louder than this. Anybody have a hearing aid? A hearing aid, one of those things that you make loud? Yeah, one of those, yeah. Okay, gentlemen, I'd like to share with you this evening are two of the success principles. If you find me a human being who succeeds in any endeavor in life, find me a person, certainly who makes it in learning, find me a person who becomes a great community leader, but find me a person who's successful in any endeavor in life, be it business, be it academics, be it sports, I guarantee that they have these two principles firmly entrenched in their essence. And find me a human being with all the talents in the world, with all of the capacity, if they don't have these two principles firmly in their essence, they will not become a fraction of what they could have been. And to share with you these two principles, let me begin with a Gemara. Gemara tells us that Ani va'ashir boin ledin. At the end of each person's life, he stands in front of Hashem. And the Gemara explains that each person has his stories, his would've, could've, and should've. And each person is given a very clear image. And they're asked, why didn't you become what you could have been? And the Gemara tells us, an Ani va'ashir, a poor man and a rich man comes ledin. And the first question they ask the poor man is, "Ma lo asak de b'torah?" I gave you a Torah which was a directive. I gave you a Torah which gave you the energy. I gave you a clear path to become great, to grow. Why didn't you learn it? Why didn't you become what you could have been? And each person begins his litany of excuses. The ani says, "Me. What do you want from me? 14 hours a day I had to work, 6 days a week. Of course I would have loved to learn, but I couldn't have done it." And each person, they answer. To the ani, they say, Klum ani ayisa yosim hillel. You were no more poor than was Hillel. And then the Gemara goes on to tell us the events of Hillel's life. When Hillel was a zakin b'Yisrael, the Gemara tells us that he would go daily to the shir of Shammai and Avitalion. And he would earn his daily keep by chopping wood. Actually, kindling wood, little sticks. And he would go into the forest, grab little sticks, put them together, and door to door he would sell them. People would use it to start their fire. Every day he would go into the woods. Every day he would sell. And every day he earned a tarpik. A tarpik was then the smallest coin in the land. Half of that money he would use to pay for his household expenses. Half of that money he would pay the shomer beis medrash. In those days, the beis medrash was out in the fields. There was a shomer, a guardsman, who protected the Jews learning there. Every day, Hillel would sell the wood. Every day, he would earn the tarpik. Every day, he paid the guardsmen. One Erev Shabbos, it was Tevis, it was wintertime. Apparently, he didn't have time to collect the wood, didn't have time to sell it. He comes to the guard and says, "Sir, every day I'm here. Every day, I gladly pay you. Today, I didn't have time to collect the money. Please let me in." The guard looks at him and says, "No. Please, no, please, no." Says Hillel, "I cannot leave Divrei Elokim Chayim." He goes to the side of the beis medrash, climbs up, and he listens to the shir from the Aruba. From the skylight. Now, as you remember the rest of the Gemara, it's not clear what happened. Either he fell asleep, or he lost consciousness. But in the morning, when Shemaiah and Avitayan look up, they see in the Aruba an image of a man covered by mounds and mounds of snow. "Quick, someone, get him down, get him down." They run up there, and they light a fire, says Shemaiah, "This man is Roy Lechalav as a Shabbos." They resuscitate him. And when the poor man comes in front of Din, they say to him, "Klum, Aniya Yisa Yosem Hillel, you were no more poor than was Hillel." And then in walks in the usher, the rich guy. "What's your excuse? He had all the money that money could buy. What's your story?" "Me. I had 700 men in my employ. The entire town came to me with problems and issues. How could I have learned?" And they say to him, "Klum usher Yisa Yosem Rebelazim Barcharsim. You were no more wealthy than was Rebelazim Barcharsim." And then the Gemara goes on to tell us the events of Rebelazim Barcharsim's life. Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim was a singular masmid, completely, totally involved in learning to the exclusion of anything else. His father was a wealthy businessman. In those days, if you owned land, you were the landlord. You set the taxes, you made the laws. His father owned 1,000 cities, the kind of wealth that doesn't exist in our world. And when his father died, all of that wealth, a king's wealth, was left to Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum in a heartbeat. He went from a regular guy to one of the wealthiest men who had lived in generations. And he didn't change an iota. The same dedication to learning, the same devotion, of plenty of people to take care of the affairs of the state. He remained the same person. And when the usher walks in front of Hashem, they say to him, why didn't you become what Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum became? Nimsa the Gemara concludes, Hillel Mechayavis Aniyim, Hillel obligates the poor people, and Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum Mechayavis Ashirim. Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum obligates the rich people. And that's the Gemara. And I got to hear my Rebbe, the Rishiva Zatzal, ask a question on this Gemara that has two parts to it. Part one sounds like this. If I stand in front of you, maybe I'm telling you the truth, and maybe I'm not. If you've ever bought a used car from someone, you know that not every word that every human being says is exactly Torah's emes. But there's a reason for that. Because as I stand here, you could hear my words, you can see my motions, but you don't know what I'm thinking. I might be thinking one thing, saying another. But the problem with this Gemara is it's not you and I, and it's not here. When my body's put in the ground, I separate, and I stand in front of Hashem. So part one of the question is, what does Hashem need Hillel? Oh, look, if Hillel could have done it, surely you could. Hashem is a ganz fine judge. Hashem created the Ani. Let Hashem peer into the essence of the Ani and say, Mr. Poor Man, you could have or you could not have. What does Hashem need Hillel? Oh, if Hillel could have done it, so too could you. Question number one is, we don't need Hillel. But question number two is a little bit more penetrating. They say in the name of the Gra that the most painful moment in your life is not that car crash, not when you hear the shattering of glass and the crash of metal, and not even when the Tzala guy pulls that sheet over your head, and not even at your funeral. They say in the name of the Gra, it's when I separate. When my body's left behind, I go up in front of the Beis Din Shamala, and they hold up this picture of Adam Gadol, this great person, this tzaddik. And they say to me, why didn't you become that? Me? Little me? What do you want from me? I'm not a big tzaddik. What do you want from me? They say in the name of the Gra, the most painful words you'll ever hear in your life are the words, that is you. That is you had you become what you could have been. That is you had you actualized your potential. That is you had you become what you were destined to be. But gentlemen, the picture is a picture of me. I'm not asked to be you. You're not asked to be him. None of us are compared to tzaddikim who lived hundreds of years ago. Each of us were put into a different body, into a different life setting, a different birth order, different community, and each of us are asked one single demanding question. How much of you did you become? 80%, 60%, 40%. But I'm not compared to you. You're not compared to him. None of us are compared to anyone else. So if question number one is we don't need Hillel, question number two is Hillel is the wrong scale of measure. Who cares? One time in history, there was a great Hillel. What does that have to do with the poor man? One time in history, there was a Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum. What does that have to do with this person standing here? Question one is, we don't need Hillel. Question number two is, Hillel is the wrong scale of measure. And I'd like to see if we can answer these two questions and understand, in fact, what this Chazal shares with us. And to do that, let me take you to a different part of the world. If you go to Asia today, you'll still find on that continent, much of the heavy lifting is done by the elephant. You can see the elephant all day long. The trainer kind of leads it. On its back will be heavy loads, and its trunk will be heavy loads. All day long, the elephant trudges through the jungle carrying. At night, the trainer ties the elephant to a peg in the ground, and the elephant remains there the entire night. Now, if you were looking at this situation, you might ask the following question. The peg is not that deep. The rope isn't that strong. Why doesn't the elephant just escape? Why does it go into the jungle, eat, do what it wants? And the answer is that the elephant can't escape. Why? Because when the elephant's born, it weighs about 250 pounds, and the baby elephant tries to escape. It tries once and it fails. It tries a second time and fails. Tries for a week. It tries for a month. And then the elephant learns the lesson. The peg is too deep. The rope is too strong. And that lesson remains fixed in its mind, even when it reaches full maturation. When it weighs 14,000 pounds, when it can plow through a cement wall like it's paper, it remains rooted in that ground because in its limited understanding, the peg is too deep, the rope is too strong. Gentlemen, that is an apt mushel for many, many people that you will meet. Many, many people that you will meet do not become a fraction of what they could have been. Not because they don't have potential, not because they don't have capacity, but because they have these limiting beliefs, these glass ceilings that hold them down. And much like the mighty elephant that could easily escape, but its mental image keeps it where it is, many people become mired to a very small image of themselves. What do you want from me? I'm a regular Joe, a regular guy. You want me to aspire for greatness? I'm going to set goals. What do you want from me? Gentlemen, I'll share with you a little prophecy. If you believe about yourself that you're plain vanilla, if you believe about yourself you're just ordinary, I guarantee you will live up to that self-prophecy. Because if you believe that you're plain, you're ordinary, you will accomplish exactly that. And many, many people do not become a fraction of what they could have been because they have these limiting beliefs, very small versions of themselves, and that keeps them in check. And every once in a while, you hear about someone who shatters a limiting belief. I'll give you an example from competitive sports. For almost 100 years, there was one record in competitive sports that was considered untouchable, unbreakable. No human being had ever run a mile in under 4 minutes. Athlete after athlete tried. Country after country sent their best. It became a cause celebrate internationally. Everyone tried to break the 4 minute mile. No one could do it. Gunga Hag in 1912 ran the mile in 4 minutes and 10 seconds. Roger Carpenter, an American fellow, ran it 12 years later. Ran in 4 minutes and 6 seconds. No one can run the mile in under 4 minutes. People began postulating all kinds of theories. Man's skeletal structure's all wrong. He creates too much wind resistance. It became an accepted medical fact that no human being can run a mile in under 4 minutes. One Australian fellow, John Landy, ran the mile in 4 minutes and 2 seconds 4 times in a row. And he said the words, "It's a brick wall. It can't be penetrated." May 5th, 1954, Roger Bannister broke the 4 minute mile. That untouchable record, unbeatable, he ran a mile in under 4 minutes. Oddly enough, 47 days later, John Landy, the Australian fellow, 4 minutes, 2 seconds, brick wall, ran the mile faster than did Roger Bannister. Stranger still, within 1 year, 32 other runners had run the mile in under 4 minutes. But here was the oddest part. Nothing changed. They didn't change technique. They didn't change running shoes. They didn't change diet. And the only thing that changed was Roger Bannister took something from the realm of impossible. He proved it could be done. Once he could do it, then John Landy could, then 32 other runners. Now any international track star runs the mile in under 4 minutes. But it took one human being to shatter the myth, to break that glass ceiling, and everyone followed suit. And it's not always in big deal headlines or competitive sports that you hear this. I'll share with you a much more down-to-earth example of a limiting belief. In 1997 in Tallahassee, Florida, a young boy was involved in a car accident. The ambulances came rushing to the scene. The EMTs were ready to help him, but they couldn't help him. See, the problem was his arm was pinned under the wheel of a car. They needed to get him to a hospital, but the car wheel was literally on top of his arm, and they couldn't get him out. What they do, get a truck, get a crane, they're having all debates. A bystander sees what's happening, doesn't consult, doesn't say a word, rushes over to the fender of the car, bends down, lifts up the car. They quickly take the boy, put him to an ambulance, ship him off to the hospital, patch him up, he's good to go. This story became a media sensation. Almost every newspaper in the United States carried the story. Why? Because the onlooker wasn't some muscular power lifter, wasn't some burly fireman. The onlooker was the boy's 63-year-old grandmother who saw her grandson under the wheel of the car. She rushed over and lifted the car. Okay. Charles Garfield is a psychologist. He wrote a book called Peak Performance. He spent 20 years of his life studying athletes who do things that you and I would say are physically impossible. I read the book. He describes athletes running for 24 hours straight. He describes athletes lifting 1,200-pound boulders. He says when he read this story in the newspaper, he said, "I must interview this woman. I must get her story." And he describes that he called her up, explained who he was, why he wanted to meet with her, what the world could learn from her. She flatly refused to speak to him. He called a second time. Again, she refused. He called a third time. Again, she refused. Months later, a fourth time, he tried one last chance. She agreed to an interview. Now, he describes that when he got to her house, she was very friendly, welcomed him in, offered him a cup of coffee. He sat down. He said, "Madam, what I want to know is one thing. Just share with me your flow of consciousness. What were you thinking? What was going on in your mind? I just want to experience that moment with you." And he says that she was very graphic and very vivid, described exactly what she was feeling, exactly what she was experiencing. And then he says, he looked at her and says, I don't get it. I don't understand this. Not the lifting the car, that part doesn't bother me. What I don't understand is why you were so reluctant to speak to me. It was clear that you were trying to hide something, but I don't get it. What you did was heroic. You saved your grandson's life. Why wouldn't you want the world to know about that? And he says that she turned to him and she said these words, if this, which I knew was impossible, I actually could do, what does it say about the rest of my life? He asked her, what do you mean? She described she always dreamt about teaching, but she never went beyond high school education. So with Dr. Charles Garfield's coaching, at the age of 63, Mrs. Laura Schultz began her college education and went on to teach college-level science. But here's the punchline. You and I know that in the real world, grandmas don't lift cars. You and I know that in the world we live in, the boys still stay stuck until they get a crane, until they get heavy machinery, because a grandma can't lift a car. Until she sees that if she doesn't do it, it won't happen. Until she sees that if she doesn't do it, it's her grandson's life, and she rushes over martial strength she couldn't imagine, taps energy she couldn't envision, and does that which she knows was impossible to do, and she shatters a myth. I heard my Rebbe, the Reshiva Zatzal, explain this Gemara this way. The poor man is not asked, why didn't you become Hillel? Hillel has his destiny, and the poor man has his destiny. The poor man is asked a much more difficult question. There was a poor man who reached his potential. Why don't you use him as a hero? Why don't you put him up on your mantelpiece? Why don't you say the words, if Hillel could do it, so too could I. He was in your generation, your time. Why didn't you say, if he could do it, so too could I? Why didn't he shatter that myth for you? And as the poor man is asked that question, so to the wealthy man is asked, why don't you use Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim as a hero? And gentlemen, that is the first rule of success in life. You have to set goals, real goals, lofty goals, demanding goals, and you have to have heroes. People who are older than you, better than you, and you can have them in different areas, but you have to say the words, wait a minute, he walks the same earth as I do, breathes the same air. Look what he accomplished. If he can do it, so too can I. Not so can I be him. So too, as he reached his potential, so too I can reach what I was put on the planet to do. And that is the first rule of success in life. You have to have lofty goals. And you have to have heroes. You have to have people you look up to, people you use as role models, people that you use as motivation to get you out of bed in the morning. And while that is the first rule of success in life, if you really live this and firmly entrench this, but don't have the second rule also in your essence, I guarantee you will fail miserably. What is the second rule of success in life? So that one I'll take you to a different stage in my life. When I was about 23, I was invited to join a very exclusive Musach Habura. Chavetz Chaim Yeshiva, what's a Musach Habura? Musach Habura is a group of guys usually about the same age. And each week, one fellow would say a Chiddush. It might be from a Chazal, it might be from a Gemara, it might be from a Musa Sefer. The idea was to say a Chiddush in Midos and Musar, and then as a group we discuss it. And again, I was invited to join this very exclusive group. First week, someone brought in a Das Kane and Balitosis, brought out a big Chiddush, we discussed it back and forth. Second week, someone brought in an Or HaSadikim. Third week, a person brought in a good Chazal. Very nice. Fourth week, my turn to present. I walked into the room, but I was not holding a Gemara, nor a Musa Sefer, nor a Chumash. I walked in carrying a picture sports book. Now, the looks turned pretty dirty, as in like, Schaefer, what do you want? So I took that picture sports book, and I opened it to the center section, where you see Muhammad Ali holding up the heavyweight championship belt. At which point, those dirty looks turned a lot worse. What do you want, Schaefer? I said, tell me what you see. All right, we get it. Frazier been the world champion. Ali just won the fight. What do you want? I said, exactly. When you look at that picture, what do you see? You see victory. You see glory. What you don't see is that Muhammad Ali got so beat up in that fight that they drove him directly to the hospital. You see him in his moment of glory. You see him in his height. But you don't see that the world champion got so beat up in that fight that for 3 weeks, 21 days, he couldn't get out of his hospital bed. But that's not the part you read about in the sports section. You read about the hype. You read about the glory. But you don't read about the amount of pain he had to go through. And what I wanted to share with my friends that day was what I call the second rule of success in life. And that is you got to know how to take a punch. Gentlemen, anybody here box? Yeah? Okay. I've done some clever things in my life. And I've done some things that are not so clever. And I've done some really dumb things in my life. When I was 18, I spent 6 months in a boxing gym. was definitely not clever. Not clever. You know, okay, here we go. Anyone know what Sara Shova, what every single semi-pro or professional fighter has in common? One thing every semi-pro or pro fighter has in common. Anyone know?
Broken nose.
I'm sorry? Broken nose? Yeah, what, anything?
Brain damage.
I'm sorry? Brain damage? Okay. What any pro or any semi-pro has in common is they are all ugly. Ugly. I'll explain to you why. The human face was not designed to be a punching bag. And no matter how fast you are, no matter how quick you get hit, you get punched, it swells, it goes down, it goes down. After 6 months, 6 years, you just don't look the same way as when you started. And every single fighter is ugly except for one. Pretty Boy Ali. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. You could watch the punches, he ducked, he slipped. He never got hit. You watch the fight slow motion, he just ducked under. He had the cleanest face in boxing. Muhammad Ali once estimated that in his professional fighting career, he got hit in the head at least 1 million times. That means at least 1 million times some 220-pound Chayara smashed him full force in the jaw. That's Pretty Boy Ali, the cleanest fighter in boxing. And what I wanted to share with my friends that day was that I don't care how much talent you have. I don't care how much ability you have. I don't even care how much drive you have. If you don't know how to take a punch, get hit, get knocked down, and get back up off the canvas, you're going to be counted out. Because no matter what happens in life, you're going to set goals, you're going to make some, miss some, hit some, miss some others. And gentlemen, make no mistake about this. This is not about competitive sports or rough and tumble fighting, boxing. You'll excuse me for this one, but I have four daughters, so I'm allowed to ask this question. What is the most feminine of competitive sports? Most feminine. Anyone? Tennis? Yeah. Most feminine of competitive sports. Shopping? No, shopping's not a competitive sport. For women it is, I know.
Netball.
I'm sorry, what?
Netball.
Okay, anyway. Again, four daughters, ice skating. You know, put a leotard and they do the hamming. Okay, all right. Here's the point. Coaches have a way to determine whether a young woman has within her the ability to become an elite athlete. What's that criteria? How many times she's able to fall and get back up. And the coaches explain why. See, first, the coach teaches you a new jump. So you go home and you practice. You jump and you spin, you jump and you spin. If you miss, the carpet catches you. Not a big deal. And the first few times, it's also not that bad. Coach puts on a harness. You go out there, you jump and you spin, you jump and you spin. If you miss, the harness catches you. But it's when the coach takes off the harness and says, go out there. It's only those athletes that are able to push themselves, knowing that if they really push themselves, they might fall. It's only those athletes that are able to reach their potential. The 2006 Olympic gold medal was won by a young Japanese girl. She was 16 when she won the gold. Her coach estimates from the time she began skating at age of 6 until 16, she fell at least 20,000 times. 10 times a skating session. Twice a day, 6 days a week, week after week, month after month, year after year. And you know why most people don't make it? Because they fall. And they fall again. And they fall another time. And they fall another time. And then there's a voice in their ear that says, cut it out. You fell. You fell again. You're not made for this stuff. You ain't got what it takes. And it's only those girls that can brush themselves off, get back on that ice, time after time after time. And gentlemen, that is the second rule of success in life. You got to know how to take a fall. You got to know how to fall down, pick yourself back up, and get in that game. Because no matter how good you are, no matter how fast you are, you're going to fall, you're going to get hit. And just to show you how pervasive this is, I want to share with you a quote. And after I say the quote, I'm going to ask you who said it. And if you get the quote right, you win a bowl of chocolate. No. You win a cigar. No. iPhone. No. Okay, anyway, here's the quote. Success consists of going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. One more time. Success consists of going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. Who said it? Sorry? Sorry? Did I say it? No. It's not a Schaefferism. No. No. Sorry, Mr. Sharm? No. Who? Who's that? Okay, the man who said it was a college professor. The man who said it was a world statesman. The man who said it won the Nobel Prize in Literature. The man who said it was knighted by the Queen of England. The man who said it was the Prime Minister of England, Sir Winston Churchill, to you. But let me tell you who Sir Winston Churchill was. Historians credit Churchill with saving the free world. If you remember a little bit of ancient history over here, 1933, Adolf Hitler's elected Reich Chancellor, who's the Prime Minister? Chamberlain. What was Chamberlain's attitude? Appeasement, Lebensraum, give him Czechoslovakia, don't make a war, don't make a fight. From the parliament floor, there was one sane voice. Churchill was the lion that roared. Adolf Hitler's a menace to society, a menace to humankind. But no one listened. And it wasn't until the war began, it wasn't until Churchill was elected prime minister. Historians say if not for his galvanizing force, the Allies would have lost. Nazis won the day. May 1945, Germany surrendered. July 1945, Churchill was voted out of office. A great wartime prime minister, but these are peace times. You need a different kind of leader. After leading England to its finest hour, after saving the free world, he found himself on the street without a job, unemployed. He picked himself up, wrote that Six Treaties work, that won a Nobel Prize, went on to fight communism, but that was his life. Success consists of going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. And gentlemen, let me explain to you what this means. Anything in life that you wish to succeed at, anything in life that you wish to accomplish, you have to set lofty goals and you got to be prepared to get knocked down and get back off the floor. And that's about little stuff like making money, winning Nobel Prizes, winning a gold medal, little stuff. What about real stuff? What about when you and I are done our job here, my body's put in the ground, and I will be forever what I shape myself into? And gentlemen, the biggest lie you're ever going to hear. Anybody hear this expression, whatever? Whatever? I don't know if you have it here, but whatever. Whatever? You ever hear? Ask a 20-year-old today, what do you want to be when you grow up? I don't know, whatever. No, what do you dream about? Whatever. What do you aspire to? Whatever. You know, make some money, spend that money, then we die. Whatever. You know, whatever. I don't know if you guys have that here. You guys have tattoos here? Mm-hmm. Tattoos? Tattoos? I took my son bowling a little while back, and I got to see the Bronx Zoo. Because the guy in the lane next to me was wearing shorts. I got to see the lions and tigers and bears. It was tattooed up and down his... Right? And I don't know if they do that over here, but they okay. Now, gentlemen, listen. I come from a different time period. I know what is tattooed. A sailor used to put a tattoo on his bicep. You know, the USSS, he put the ship. A Marine used to put on his deltoid, put the core. I got that. Could you explain to me Pez candy dispensers on your chest? Can you explain to me going into a tattoo parlor, taking a McDonald's receipt and telling them, put that up and down my arm, please. Big Mac, fries, Coke, tax. Could you explain it to me? Okay, so listen, everybody's got the Yetzirah. I got a Yetzirah. I love to get the story. What made you put the tattoo on? I'm just like, I gotta ask. So I try to get the story. Okay, anyway, I'm in CVS, one of the drugstores in New York City. I give the guy some money. He hands me back the change. And there on his arm, I see the words Barbara. B-A-B, Barbara, emblazoned on his forearm. My Yetzirah flashed, so I had to get the story. How do you get the story out of a guy? Anyone know? You say the words, man, nice tattoo. Yeah, well, so then I say to him, tell me, does Barbara have your name tattooed on her arm? Nah, she's way too smart for that. Okay, listen to what he's saying. He knows that this is one girlfriend. There's going to be a second, a third, a fourth, fifth, first wife, second wife, third wife, fifth wife. When he's 45, he won't even remember who Barbara was, but for the rest of his life, emblazoned on. So here's my question. Here's my goodness of question. What are you thinking? What's with your brain? Don't you realize what you're doing? You're putting this on your body forever. Do you understand the depth of this question? Does anyone know the answer? Would you like to know the profound answer to this question? The answer is whatever. My body's an etch-a-sketch. Whatever. Who cares? I'm a slum rat. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Gentlemen, the most pervasive disease of the 21st century is this disease of whatever. We're a bunch of nobodies, nothings. Who cares? Whatever. So I'll share with you a Chiddush Nora. I do not accept that Hashem took you from under the Kisei HaKavod, hand-selected for you the perfect life, this family, this generation, this birth order. Go out there, ford those streams, climb those mountains, become great. And you come back afterwards and whatever you'll be good. You'll be good, I'll be good, we'll all be good. Gentlemen, do you hear what I'm saying? You don't hear what I'm saying. You know why you're not afraid? Anybody here trembling from what's going to be like after I leave this earth? Anybody wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to get to work. Oh, my gosh, I got to grow. I got to come. Anybody here? Let's be honest, candid. Anybody here? No. Oh, why not? Because we're so great? I'll tell you why not. It's really very simple. First of all, I have no plan on dying. I have really no plan of serious, no serious plans of dying. It's only not in this lifetime. So I don't really got to worry about it. And even if I go to a funeral, and even if I really get it one day, it doesn't matter. You know why? Because I know what it's going to be like. We're all going to be angels in white. We're all going to be angels in white. I'll have big fluffy white wings. You'll have big fluffy white wings. And we'll dance around together in joy and celebration for eternity, ever and ever and ever. So I'd like to share with you, Mitzvah Shem will all be there. Mitzvah Shem, some people will be phenomenally great. However, here's the observation. Exactly what you shape yourself into is what you will be for eternity. And what that means is if you work and you steig and you grow and you become great, you'll be great. And if you whatever, for eternity, you're going to be whatever. And if it doesn't bother you here, it's only because we're sound asleep. And only because we're living in a slumber. Gentlemen, I'll make it very clear. Mirtza Hashem, many, many years from now, we will all meet again. I'm pretty confident. At least I hope to be there. And I hope you'll be there too. And I am certain that there'll be some people from this group who will be shining like the sun at midday. Powerful, brilliant. You know, some guys, some guys, whatever. And there'll be a few people, demeanor to squish, little crippled, little nothings. And here's the point. Exactly what you're going to be forever is based on one thing. How much you put your brain on, how much you get to work, how much you serve Hashem, how much you grow, how much you use the Torah to accomplish what you put here to be. Gentlemen, hear what I'm saying. This group is a wonderful group, and I'm very, again, honored and proud that Yossi invited me, but I want to share with you this basic yisod. And this yisod is that for eternity you are what you shape yourself into. And more than anything, it's this world and the next world. Gentlemen, anyone know what the single most enjoyable activity you'll ever do is? Sorry, I have a disease. I apologize. I have a disease. Anyone have that disease? It's ADHD. I get distracted. I'm distracted. And as soon as I see one of these things, I usually find myself doing sheer texting people about all the cool things I'm about to say. Do you guys mind if I send a text? I'm sorry. Do you guys know what the single most enjoyable thing you'll ever do in your life is? Anyone know? I'd like to share with you what it is. When you set a goal and you reach 60%, 70%, even 50% of it, it's the single most enjoyable thing you'll ever do. And you know why? Because that's what God created you to do. Hashem put us into this world imperfect, gave us the Torah, gave us mitzvahs, gave us the ability to change the essence of me, and that is the single most enjoyable activity you'll ever do. Why? It's what you created to do. You were put here imperfect, given the tools, given the capacity, and the most enjoyable thing you could do is put your brain on. And by the way, you know the most the most distasteful, disgusting, abhorrent thing in the world is? Whatever. You ever vegetate? You ever spend a day doing nothing? You ever spend a day just whatever? How about a week? How about a month? How about a year? How about 10 years? If you spend enough time, whatever, there's a sense of vacuousness, a vacuum within you. There's just emptiness and the self-abhorrence. And all it does to change that around is to start learning, start growing, start accomplishing. I think this Chazal shares with us a tremendous yesod. And that yesod is, Hillel is not the role model for the Ani that the role model should live up to. Much more difficult. The Ani is asked, there was a man who shattered the limiting belief. He became what he could be. Why don't you use him as your role model to become what you could have been? Not why don't you become Hillel, why don't you become you? And every person has different strengths, different talents, and each person is asked one question, how much of you did you become? The usher is asked, why don't you become Reb Elazar bar Charsam, why don't you become you? And the Ani is asked, why don't you become you? And that is the single most powerful, most painful moment of a person's life when they show you that picture of what you could have been. And the Ani, for years and years, for decades, was saying the words, of course I would have wanted to learn. Of course, but I was too distracted. I was too busy. I was too whatever. And in a flash, in a lightning flash of reality, he sees what he could have been. And then he realizes it was a lie. It was a sheker. He really could have put the brain on. He really could have changed. He really could have grown. And in that moment, he realizes, but then it's too late. As long as you're alive, as long as there's breath in your lungs, as long as there's blood in your veins, you can grow, you can change. That's the beauty of life. And gentlemen, I'll close with one last thought. What happens to the elephant when it discovers that the peg isn't that deep and the rope isn't that strong? It was 1944 in Hartford, Connecticut. Barnum and Bailey parked the trucks outside the town. In those days, when there was a circus, and they used to take the circus by train, then by truck, to the different locales, and they would pull out this huge tent. And under this tent, they put up the three rings, and that's how the circus traveled from town to town. In any case, to make the tent waterproof, they used to coat it with paraffin. Paraffin, as you know, is water repellent, but paraffin is also highly flammable. In any case, it's Hartford, Connecticut. The circus is on, the show is going, and somehow the tent catches fire. Smoke, flames, pandemonium, people running, people crashing. 121 people died. And finally, in the end, they put out the fire, and the circus crew began gathering together what was left of the circus. The trainer found that the elephants were gone. They had been tied up. It wasn't their turn to be in the act. When the fire began, they were tied up, and suddenly they were gone. He couldn't find them. He took a bunch of guys with him, and they began walking and walking and walking. They couldn't find them. A mile away, finally, in some meadow, they found a small herd of elephants. And trainer took one, gave a rope to each of the other guys, and they walked the small herd of elephants back to the camp where they had the circus. And the trainer describes, he tied the elephants up, turned around, turned back, and the elephants were gone. He tied them again, and the elephants were gone. You see, the smoke, the flame, pandemonium, the elephants forgot the lesson, they broke out, and once the elephant realized that the peg was not deep enough, the rope wasn't strong enough, it never could be tied again, Barnum and Bailey had to retire that entire herd. They had to bring in a new herd of elephants, because once the elephant learned the lesson, it can never be tied again. Gentlemen, when you set real goals, I will, by such and such date, accomplish this. I will finish this. I will learn this. I will do this. And you reach a goal. You know what happens? Number one, there's a sense of empowerment within you. Number two, there's a sense of happiness. But more than anything, you change your understanding of what you are. You change your understanding of what you can be. And suddenly horizons open up and you start climbing and you start growing. You become bigger and bigger. And especially if you're still young, and young means 80 and younger, you can change the direction of your life. You can change where you're heading. It takes one thing. It takes setting goals and demanding of yourself. And then it takes understanding that you got to be ready to take a punch. I want to thank Yossi again for inviting me. And I want to wish you all much hatzlacha. There is a Shmooze podcast for those who are up with the times. If you listen on, what do you listen to on iHeartRadio or Spotify or iTunes or any of those things? But for you guys who are too pure, Baruch Hashem, there's still the Shmooze app. Don't get a smartphone. Don't go on the internet if you do go to shmooze.com. Now, if you don't do any of those things, it's still called a Lashon. So Baruch Hashem, there's still some hope. But anyway, it's spelled funny, T-H-E-S-H-M-U-Z. Again, the podcast is each week, and the Shmooze app and the shmooze.com. And again, I thank you.